Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On the show today, we're going to the theatre, but this theatre could be anywhere. It could be in a bar, a stairwell, an old warehouse, or on the street. We're talking immersive theatre, which isn't a new thing, but it's certainly become a trendy one. But is that down to the whole experience industry? Are we so concerned with where we are or where people think we are on social media that we just want to be part of the performance? Or are savvy producers just trying to find a location where they can afford to stage their play? On the show today, we'll meet a few people from the industry to find out why immersive theatre has become such a hit. That's all ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bound. First, we'll hear from a director. Susie Wilson is a co-founder of Clod Ensemble, a company that combines music and movement to create immersive theatre and dance pieces in alternative spaces. She tells producer Holly the challenges of directing a play off stage.
I think that there's a long tradition of theatre happening in all sorts of different places. And the brilliant thing about performance and theatre is that for every generation it reinvents itself because the very nature of live performance is so ephemeral. So I think there's a history of theatre in unusual spaces, but what's been happening certainly in the last 5-10 years, I think, is artists wanting to work in different kinds of spaces for different kinds of pieces. So, for example, with Clod Ensemble, some of our work is suited to an audience in a gallery space. So we did a piece called Silver Swan at the Turbine Hall at the Tate, where the audience looked down from the balcony. So in that piece, it was important that we had control of the viewing position of the audience because it was a piece about these kind of little human beings in a massive space, and we wanted the audience to reflect on that. Whereas a piece like Under Glass, which we're touring this autumn, for that piece we need the audience to get very close to the performers because they're all in test tubes or petri dishes, they're all in these glass containers. And the piece is about how we look at human beings. And we want the audience to get up close and we want them to be really interested and curious, not only in what they're looking at, but how they're looking. So that piece is about the nature of what it means to look at someone and what it means to objectify them. And however much we try to objectify by saying that's this kind of person or that kind of person, actually, the way Under Glass is presented, you can't help but see the poetic, the little kind of narrative, as well as the fact that this human being is in a jar for the audience to watch. So our work has always taken the context and the viewing position into account.
Well, perspective was something that I wanted to talk to you about, because when you're doing something perhaps more immersive where you can't control exactly where the audience are going to be at all times, what are the challenges in directing a piece like that, as opposed to somewhere where the crowd's going to be static in seats?
How you guide the audience around. So even in the performances where you think that the audience have a free rein and they can go where they want, it's been really thought through where they can go. And, you know, just on a really practical level in terms of, is the pathway lit that they can walk through so they can see where they're going? So I think there's lots of technical demands. And often when you're working in buildings and you're using the buildings in a different way, part of the challenge is to get the technical team on board. So, for example, we did a piece called An Anatomy in Four Quarters at Sadler's Wells. And if you know Sadler's Wells Theatre, it's a beautiful theatre with over 1,000 seats in it. But we did a piece where only 200 people could watch it at a time. And they started in the gods right at the back and watched the first quarter. And then they walked down the internal staircase, watched from the dress circle, the stalls, and then they ended up on the stage, which was brilliant because the piece was about anatomy and dissection and dissecting the space. But you can imagine for the technical team at Sadler's Wells, they'd never had anything happen in the auditorium in that way before. So that's the kind of pleasure of the work that we do. It encourages people who work in theatres or, you know, in whichever spaces that we're working in to look at the spaces that they're inhabiting in a slightly different way. And I think that's part of the pleasure of making work that's maybe coming from a slightly different place than just a straight kind of conventional, the audience just going to sit down and watch what they're told to watch.
You were talking earlier about how artists want to explore different spaces. Do you think that also there's a problem with funding and things like that, and sometimes artists have to choose their space depending on what they can afford to use, but then that can also spark creativity?
I think that's a very good question because, of course, the economic context is as important to a, especially live performance, actually, where you can put on the work. So, you know, Sadler's Wells putting on an anatomy, for example, you know, that is a theatre that usually would have thousands of people in it. So there's a commercial need to fill those seats. So sometimes it's brilliant when the theatres can take risk and actually think of their auditorium as a stage, as well as just the place where the tickets get sold. Yeah, I think there's a very different economy in the visual art world to the performance world, because in visual art, mainly, there's a product that people can buy.
There's more of a commercial side
Absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely. And so I think it's interesting, this new group of artists who are presenting work in galleries and what works are being presented in parallel with that, whether it's an essay or an object that can also be taken away by the audience.
I think there's a real thing at the moment, especially with sort of the social media side of things, where people want to be part of something. You know, they want to say that they were there, they were included in something. And do you think that kind of inclusive nature of immersive theatre is what might be driving some of it at the moment as well?
Definitely. I think there's a real desire for engaging with art in different ways and for people to have control over where they're looking from. And I wonder how that will pan out over the next 10 years. I know during my time working in the theatre, you see kind of fashion of genre shift and evolve over time. So I think, as I said, I have a real love for the dark theatre where you sit and you just watch something amazing in front of you, and it's a kind of peaceful, calm, contemplative place. But also I love the engagement and the interaction. It's a matter of taste. I mean, some people find the idea of being in a show where they have to get involved quite frightening. And even though I'm a theatre director, I have to say I find that quite nerve-wracking too. So in our pieces, Under Glass, for example, there's no audience participation. You know, it's just about where they're viewing from. And some of these glass containers, you have to actually get close and look from above. But the audience don't have to participate. And even in a Punch Drunk show, for example, the audience are wearing masks. In Claude shows, we don't demand that kind of level of performativity, if you like, from the audience. But what we do give them is some choices, and for them to reflect on what it means to, you know, look at these amazing dancers and actors who are putting themselves out there to be watched and interpreted.
Talking about actors and performers and dancers, how do they feel about it? Because when you're on the traditional stage, there's a very clear barrier. How about when they've got people very much in their personal space when they're acting?
Well, it's interesting with Under Glass because they're under glass. So there is a boundary. And actually some of the performers who we've asked to be in it, you know, do express an anxiety about having that barrier. So somehow in the theatre, where there's the light so you can't often see the audience, but there's nothing in between. So, for example, theatre works where there's a gauze in front of the stage, often performers do feel this disconnect. With Under Glass, because it's about that, you know, I think the audience feel comfortable and there's a playfulness. There are moments where the performers do catch the eye of the audience, and then there are moments when they're just in their own beautiful kind of world. And that's another thing that I like with this allowing the audience to get close up. This possibility of how you use space really changes your kind of relationship to the world. And even when we find ourselves in a corner or a tight space, we can reposition ourselves to feel free. And I suppose that theme of how human beings negotiate the spaces and environments around them is one that's very close to my heart and has informed our work all the way through, which is perhaps why we tend to use these spaces in such different ways.
Do you think immersive theatre is having a moment right now, and do you think that it's going to last long? How do you sort of see the future of this trend at the moment?
Certainly, artists of my generation and a kind of younger generation coming through want to show their work in different contexts and want to explore different relationships with audience. You know, there's a lot of work, I think, at the moment, which is using instructions, so people get the instructions on their phone. And I can't see that going away. I think that this is a very exciting moment in terms of the way people use technologies. That being said, there's still a real love of what happens just watching an amazing performer in a space, whether that is on the stage or whether you're up close to them in a gallery or on the street. So hopefully the way our cultural institutions work will help performers to be flexible like that, so that they don't just get stuck in one way of making, and that they're able to nourish their creativity in all sorts of different ways. And I think there's a real openness to that now, and a desire from it, from cultural institutions, from artists, and also from audiences. So it's exciting.
That was Susie Wilson, co-founder of Clod Ensemble. Their latest production, Under Glass, will be on at Sadler's Wells in London, as well as travelling to Manchester, Cardiff and Brighton this autumn. Head to clodensemble.com for more details. So, what do the critics think of all this immersiveness? Matt Wolfe is a regular voice on Monocle 24 when it comes to the stage. He's theatre critic for the International New York Times. Recently, he was in the Big Apple for a performance of Michael Moore's divisive anti-Trump play, The Terms of My Surrender, which isn't intended to be immersive, but elements of it certainly have become so. Matt tells us what he thinks immersive theatre means.
I think there are several things. One is that it's about redefining the relationship between the actor and the audience. So it's not so much about the audience sitting in rows staring at people in front of them. It sometimes involves moving around, the audience being ambulatory. It also has a lot to do with making the audience the storyteller. There are a lot of immersive theater experiences. Punch Drunk, a company well known in Britain and elsewhere, has pioneered this kind of thing, where you go to a place to see whatever the piece is, but then when you get there, you and your friends might separate and then come back several hours later, and each person has had a different experience. So it's allowing the audience to shape his or her own narrative of what's happened. And a lot of it, of course, has to do with extending the playing space beyond the footlights, so that the action is kind of happening around you or above you or below you or whatever. And then sometimes it just has very simply to do with the venue. There was a very successful off-Broadway show here, which has moved to Broadway. It's finishing in a week or two, called Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1912. And it began in a tent off-Broadway with the actors kind of commingling amongst the audience. And when they moved it to Broadway, they tried to keep that same sort of setup in a Broadway house, which is very unusual, but they seem to have succeeded.
You get invited to hundreds of plays all the time. Have you found that you've had an influx of invitations to immersive theatre over the past few years? Have you sort of seen that trend happening?
Yes, and very often there's an element of mystery to it. In other words, come to a secret location for 7 o'clock and you will be met and taken to wherever. Or the idea is to have the destination be as improbable as possible. I mean, there was one a couple of years ago somewhere in Shoreditch, which was 90% of it was finding the place itself. And then once you got there, it seemed to be a whole array of storage lockers and an often abandoned car park. And so that was as much the event as anything that happened once you arrived. It was just kind of getting there. So I think this is all about shaking up with what the theatrical experience can and might be, and to inject a little bit of hipster energy, dare I say, into it, lest theaters seem a little old hat.
When it's all about finding the venue, do you lose from the play then? Does it take the attention away from the actual acting, or is less focus given to it, or is less effort put into the actual play?
It's a good question. I sometimes feel that with some, not all of course, immersive theatre, the overriding concept has been given more thought perhaps than the individual details. So it's not so much about individual performance. It's not about quality acting necessarily. These aren't actors who win Olivier Awards. It's about kind of the experience with a capital E, and that's the main thing. And sometimes the details suffer a bit. But I suppose that the conceptualizers, because that's what these people are, I mean, they're high concept strategists who are applying their wares in a theatrical environment, I guess they would say that if you want, you know, detailed, nuanced acting, you can find it in a Chekhov play at, you know, the National Theatre or wherever. And this is about giving you a very different kind of experience. I just think sometimes there can be such an emphasis on trying to surprise or startle or confuse or whatever that you lose sight of the forest for the trees. But by and large, I think it's a wonderful thing, and I look forward to immersive experience.
And you're in New York at the moment, where you've just seen the new Michael Moore play, The Terms of My Surrender. Tell us a bit about what this play is about.
Well, that is not immersive theater, although there was an interesting experience last week. This was before I arrived here, when Donald Trump, who is the subject of much of the show, although not the entire show, but Donald Trump was in New York, staying in his apartment building that bears his name. And after one of the evening performances last week, unexpectedly, from the audience's point of view, took the entire audience, or as many people as wanted, onto several buses that were parked outside the Belasco Theater, and up they went to Trump Tower to protest. So that's not what you normally get when you go to see the Phantom of the Opera. You don't normally have buses outside the theater taking you out to a protest. So that's a very different theatrical experience. But yesterday afternoon when I saw the show, there was no post-performance protest. But I think the point of the piece, it's not really a play. It's a rallying cry. It's a call to arms. It's Michael Moore, who, of course, is a very impassioned Democrat, well known from Oscar-winning films and books and so on, but not well known as a Broadway performer. So he's taking his act to the public in a city, New York, that would be very sympathetic to what he has to say. I mean, you know, it's a generally left-leaning city. It's not a city that voted for Trump, even though, ironically, it's the city in which Trump lives. But I think it's an opportunity for people who feel similarly disaffected by what's going on in America at the moment to kind of come together for a couple of hours and share a sympathetic space. But more than that, he wants you to leave the theater energized. He wants to make 900 people a show into activists. And I think he is largely successful in that. It's pretty hard if you're not sympathetic to what he's saying, it's pretty hard to emerge from the show unenergized by his message.
You kind of said at the beginning of this that it's definitely not a piece of immersive theatre, but it has got elements of audience participation, but also it's immersing itself within real life. Do you think that maybe this is just a different type of immersive theatre?
Yeah, except it isn't immersive theater because it's happening in Broadway House and it's rows of people facing a stage. And, you know, the ticket prices, which are very high for this, you know, well over $100 for the best seats. Although there are lots of $29 seats up in the balcony, which were full yesterday. And Michael Moore is very engaged with the people in the cheaper seats because I think he feels that they are the future of his argument. And I think he's right. But what would be really immersive would be if this show were staged 8 times a week in front of Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue, but that'll never happen. I mean, you couldn't get a license for that and it wouldn't work and you couldn't make a commercial. So I suppose what he's done is he's taken some of the precepts of commercial theater in terms, as you say, of engagement and keeping it improvisatory and so on, and wedding them to the traditional confines of a Broadway house. And the result is something in between both worlds. But it'll be interesting, you know, Broadway has awards every spring, the Tony Awards, so those will be next June. It'll be interesting to see what category this show is put in, because it isn't really a play. Will Michael Moore be nominated for Best Actor? Well, he's playing himself. So I don't know, it'll be interesting to see how it is regarded just in terms of industry categorization. But I would certainly recommend anyone who is politically on the same wavelength of the same spectrum to give it a go. And if you can get the $29 seats, so much the better.
A lot of the focus of these performances tends to be on the location. In the Slovenian capital of Ljubljana, an old power station has been repurposed for exactly this reason. It's called Stara Mesna Elektrana and is run by a non-profit cultural events organisation called Bunker. Monocle's correspondent Guy Delaunay has more.
Now, if you don't take the responsibility, who will take the responsibility? Because you see, those guys, they are not taking any responsibility.
So it was the first power plant in Ljubljana. The building is over 125 years old. It has been renovated a couple of times. Now it's not working anymore, at least not in its full capacity as it used to.
So it used to be a generator?
Yeah, it used to be a generator. I mean, here in the first space, which is like still, it's not a museum, but it's things are protected. It is industrial heritage, the machines inside.
Welcome to the final conference of the Secret Experimental Observatory for Global Matters.
Just having a venue like this with the history that it's got, and maybe even the personality that it's got, does that affect the productions that you put on?
Even though it's just one space, but it's quite flexible what we can do in here in order to change it, to like put audience on the stage and then raise up here the seatings and have the stage on the other side. The biggest participatory theaters or shows that we did was in 2005, I think, in summer. It was called Laugh Banks. So basically, in this venue where we are now, the seatings were not here, so it was like 25 meters long. We built another city. And the idea was that artist that did it was like she was suffering for a really bad breakup, and then she had a lot of pain and blah, blah. So she started to think, like, what if the pain would have value? 50 experts, we would call them people who would have interesting people that we knew, not famous or anything, like our friends, people from the neighborhood. They would be willing to sit there and give some advice on pain in general, like they could have their own little title, what their expertise would be. When you came in, you just either you hated it immediately and you left, or you just completely let go and you step into this game and you play for 2 days.
I think it's super clear, like this need to take a stand, to give an opinion, but also create a space to share thoughts and to share experience.
What sort of reactions do you get from people when they're asked to participate? Is this something that people have been very willing to do, or have you had to develop methods to encourage them to take part?
I think it depends on what you demand of them. I think you need to make which artists who are dealing with this kind of projects, I think they're aware of it, that they need to make like cozy environment where people feel safe and not exposed. Nobody wants to be ridiculed on the stage. You have shows where you have to play because otherwise it's like not happening. And then you have shows where you just invite it. You can just observe, so then it's up to you.
To be honest, well, for sure, it sucks as well.
This year we had a kind of a special participatory project with the artist David Weber Krebs. It's called Lights Out, where basically at the second half of the show, each member of the audience get their own switch and you're in charge of one light on the stage. People start to like turn on the lights, but there's always in the audience of 80, there's always somebody who will do the opposite or who will have a different idea. It can become political. Some people leave the chair and go on the stage just to make the point, it's not me, my light, it's not on, and so on. And I think in Ljubljana, the first night, it was like for almost 3 hours. You never know how long it will last.
It's like you start to experience being with others in another way, but also the way how you perceive the time.
You did say at the start, when you opened up this space as a performance venue, that you canvassed the people in the area and what they wanted was something where they weren't consumers. How do you think it changes people to take part in that sort of performance?
I hope they just like kind of expand the idea what kind of art we have around us, what is considered performance, or who is performer. But it's more like personal, I think. It's a new experience, I guess.
The business of all things immersive and the experience industry hasn't just been used for entertainment purposes, but also for promotional publicity stunts. Ferza Bruta is the name of a theatre company who created a performance that goes by the same title. It's been an international hit, having toured from its home in Buenos Aires to New York, London, Taiwan and beyond. But as well as this show, the company recently collaborated with Nike for the launch of their latest shoe. Frederick Bernas reports.
As the proverbial curtain went up for another performance of Fuerza Bruta, hundreds of people were clustered together, excitedly chatting, wondering what to expect. But there was no curtain, and very little else that you'd find in a traditional theatre. When the lights went out, the show began with a ferocious beat and drummers on stage, replicating a traditional Argentine street carnival. From there, it became progressively stranger and more surreal. Powerful fans suddenly blasted air from behind. Paper confetti showered from the ceiling, lights flashed, acrobats flew through the air. The crowd was pushed back and a giant treadmill appeared, with a man running at full speed, trapped in a furious cycle of movement. So, what is Fuerza Bruta? It's been described as physical theatre, action theatre or immersive theatre, and at times it recalls the Cirque du Soleil. There is no dialogue and maybe not even a clear narrative. Actress Dana Haber says it's all about breaking down boundaries and letting the audience find their own meanings.
Para mí, Fuerza Bruta es una experiencia, ¿cómo decir? Una experiencia de vida.
For me, Fuerza Bruta is a life experience. It's a state of energy, happiness, disinhibition, explosion, all the sensations that we feel as human beings. It's a party, but at the same time, you go through moments of danger. It opens all your senses at the same time. In the theater, there's no back or front, up or down. The scenes happen at all angles, from all sides, which builds energy as the show goes on.
Bueno, esa energía se va aumentando a medida que el show se sucede.
The most visually striking moment was when a transparent swimming pool descended from above, coming close enough for the audience to reach up and touch. Four performers jumped around and played in the shallow water, inviting people to look at the human body from a radically different perspective. The sheer physicality of Fuerza Bruta, which translates as brute force, does full justice to its name. And that emphasis on endurance is one thing which attracted Nike to recruit the Fuerza Bruta crew for a special advertising campaign. The project represented a curious case of a theatre company crossing over into the corporate world. Dana Haber was part of the Nike production.
Fue la primera vez que tuvimos una corredora mujer, que es una corredora de maratón olímpica.
That was the first time we had a female runner, who was an Olympic marathon contender from Argentina. It was great to fuse our ideas in a sporting mega company, and we had to prepare everything in a different way. What we do isn't exclusively sport, but there's a big physical element, so the collaboration was interesting for us.
Fuerte, por ende, tenemos mucha relación con lo con el deporte. Entonces, nada, está bueno. Yo creo que es interesante.
Adapting a successful formula to different needs is something the Fuerza Bruta creators have plenty of experience in doing. Although their core message seeks a universal resonance, the artists often rethink particular elements of the piece when they go on tour. Here's Camila Taranto, who has traveled around the world with the company for 7 years.
Lo lindo que tiene este show es que cambia, cambia con la gente.
The beautiful thing about this show is that it changes depending on the people and the country where we perform. The public is part of the spectacle, and that's different for every culture, like in Japan, where people are more reserved than somewhere like Argentina, for example. Our job as artists is to think about those things, so people can understand the show, enjoy it, and get involved.
Y a partir de eso, trabajar el show.
The Japanese production incorporated cultural references like samurai warriors and martial arts, but the intimacy and immersivity of the experience always remain the same, no matter where the show goes. The Argentina season recently came to an end, but international tours are in the pipeline, so keep an eye out for the Fuerza Bruta crew in a city near you soon. For Monocle, in Buenos Aires, I'm Frederick Bernas.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was the ever-immersive Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, thanks for tuning in.